This is the Gospel Revolution.
Since you're knocking on the door, you're begging to come in, yeah. Unaware that all the wildness been knocking from within. You are the love you seek, a perfect yet unique, righteous, holy.
Here's the founder and president of the Gospel Revolution, Michael Lilborn Williams.
Hello, Daniel Thomas Rouse. How are you today, my friend?
I am doing good, Michael Lilborn Williams.
I decided instead of saying morning, afternoon, evening, we just use today.
Good day.
Yeah, that way we don't have to lie to anybody about anything. Yes, good day. And it comes in handy. And again, we resurrect Don Bartlett once again. It seems that we can't even get it into a minute of the show that he's not poking his nose into things, right?
I was just thinking about him yesterday and just really missing him. And just was one of those moments I wish I could have picked up my phone and give him a call.
I know. Boy, it just happens so often. I think for all of us who had that pleasure, and I think it happens for the rest of the GRs just in, coming on and hearing our voices. Not that they don't enjoy ours, but I'm sure that they have those moments just having that time that's like, wow, I miss Don. And we all do, for sure.
And the beautiful thing is, when you're missing them, go on to Gospel Revolution. There are hundreds, if not thousands, of hours of just Don.
Just Don, yes. Goodness, he filled his space while he was here. And not nearly enough, but we've got a lot. So enjoy. There's a tremendous amount there. I want to just say again, along with Daniel, please go back and look at Don's research in the scriptures and how they're established. We really do need to wash away this barrage of assault against the scriptures, against the Hebrew scriptures. And Don does such a magnificent job of really diffusing this disrespect for the Hebrew scriptures. We want you to know we respect the Hebrew scriptures. We respect it like Jesus respected it. We respected it like Paul, like Peter, James, and John, like all of the writers of the New Testament, respected the Hebrew scriptures and had confidence in the Hebrew scriptures. We also have confidence in the Hebrew scriptures. Do we understand all of the Hebrew scriptures? No, but what we do not understand, we do not allow that to offend us. And Jesus said, "Blessed is he who is not offended in me." So as Jesus said, if you don't believe Moses, you can't believe me. If you're offended at Moses, you're offended at Jesus.
Wow. Just reminiscing about Don's session that he did that up in Calgary, I believe, and many other times he talked about it. But the scriptures that he went through, and just, I like the historical side of things that he brings out about how they've just stood the test of time.
Yeah,
and he had proven the validity of the scriptures, not just by how many other Christians proved the Bible's validity, which was inside the Bible, but he went outside the Bible to prove that the scriptures are legitimate.
Yes.
And I really appreciate that. He went at it from every angle, as Don so intelligently did many, many times on every topic he talked about.
If you got into Don wanting to convey to you his point, you should be ready for a full-on assault of that subject. I mean, he left no prisoners. He took no prisoners. He was out for the slaughter, for sure.
We also have a new document on the website about the scriptures. You can find that if you go right to the website. It's on the homepage. And it's something that is a work in progress. And it's just really showing why we stand true to the scriptures. So check out just check out the website. Yeah. There's great content. And if you just go to the search bar and type scriptures, you're going to have a ton of content. So we love the scriptures. And Michael, I cannot tell you how excited I am about what we have been going through here in the Hebrew scriptures, specifically in Micah. My goodness, it has been, I am just, I'm in awe. My mind is blown.
Well, mine too. And even as we got into the rhythm of the story that is in this book, as we begin to digest and then regurgitate, if you will, the story that we were seeing, it did get very exciting. And we followed that comparison. And you're going to see more of that because we've got to go into Micah chapter 5 to even finish this portion of the story that begins in chapter 4 in the last days as that chapter starts. And this story about Mary and about the birth of Christ does not end, and we assume it ends in chapter 5, verse 5. Now, most likely it continues beyond that, but that's the portion that we are looking at here in the entirety of this, and we cannot find a place where it breaks away from the description of this period of time in history of the conception, the birth of Christ, the exile of Mary and Joseph into Egypt, into Babylon, all the way through to, now this seems to be taking in that particular part of the whole story about Mary's involvement and Joseph into the bringing in of the Christ. It really is very powerful and should not have ever been overlooked. We've done some research into other people's study, and we see where that some have found, a verse here and a verse there out of Micah 4 and 5, and they admit that those verses as standalone, that's all about the cross, right? Or it's all about Jesus. But this is the first account that I know of anyone going into this entire chapter, and actually chapter and a half is what we'll be going through, or chapter and a third, exactly a third, because it has 15 verses in the next one. So we'll call this the study of one and a third. So,
so Michael, I have a question about this and just get your thoughts on it. So I think I remember in Bible school, one of the rules of Bible interpretation was, it was called something like double inference or something like that, the rule of double inference, in that which you have a story in the Hebrew scriptures. I mean, you can pick any of them, Abraham or Moses or whoever. And though the story is their story, mm-hmm. it's something that happened to them. The double inference is not only was it for Abraham's story, but it's also a prophetic image of Christ. And yes. So I'm seeing that too in a lot of what we're studying yeah. is, and some of what we're going to perhaps go to today is you see some reference like Babylonian or different things like that. It was something that happened, but it is also a prophetic image of something in from their standpoint that was going to happen
yes.
and that was in Christ. Am I true in seeing it that way?
I have never heard the term before, but I didn't go to Bible school like you did. So I didn't get to double dip. So, but the, that does, it certainly sounds reasonable. As long as we're not looking for confirmation bias, as long as that inference to what happened to them and is that inferring to something in the future, which would here would be the cross, as long as the context supports that, yes. And yeah. that's the thing, of course, that we try to do is there's a whole lot of really wonderful things about how we were taught that will be very supportive and helpful to us if we remember context, context, context.
Preach, brother.
And man, have we.
That can't be said enough.
I mean, we could just say context every time and then sign off and let you go study yourself. But holding context is it's tricky. I don't care what you're reading or watching. If you don't know the context, I've told people before, I'm a fan of Grey's Anatomy. And I've watched it once all the way through, and that's like 18 seasons. Jeez. shows you I have no life. And so actually, I started it again, and it's taken me a little bit of time. But when I have time, I just want to sit down and do anything, especially avoid the news. Then I turn on the tragedies of Grey's Anatomy. So. And let me give you a key about Grey's Anatomy from my observation. This is all free, folks. You don't even have to pay for this. If somebody comes into the hospital with a minor cut, got a little headache, or I stubbed my toe, they're going to die. They are going to die. If somebody comes in with a tree rammed through the middle of their chest and the other part of the tree is up through their chin, going through their brain, they are going to survive.
So, that TV drama at its best.
I'm telling you, you've got to always expect the unexpected. So the greater the trauma, the more powerful the outcome. And the less the trauma, the more devastating the outcome. So
I remember that was similar to Dr. House. I was really into Dr. House when that was around, too.
Yeah, and they probably got it all from Dr. Kildare, which you don't even know who I'm talking about.
No idea.
Dr. Kildare was the very first TV doctor. Oh, my gosh. And what a handsome man he was. So black and white TV, too. I mean, that's how far that goes back. But boy, they sure found out what worked with Dr. Kildare. And from there off, it has been, they've all been a spinoff from Dr. Kildare. That's all there is to it. But I don't think in Dr. Kildare, they were having booty calls in the on-call room. So anyway, between the residents and the doctors, it's like, oh my gosh, is that all these people do? It's like surgery and booty calls. You know, that's pretty much the whole show. Anyway, I digressed a bit.
And now you know why I wanted to be a brain surgeon.
Yeah, exactly. This is, yeah, it's yes. And I will not take that conversation any further than that. So.
Anyways, Micah.
Yes. So the context, like if I were to take one of those, if I were to jump in the middle of Grey's Anatomy and just watch one show, I don't know that. You know, Meredith's husband's dead and she's got a new sister that she didn't know she had. And that, Dr. Weber is actually the father of her sister. And, you know, it's just minor things you need to know. Context, context, context.
Nicole watched Grey's Anatomy a lot too. And she would ask me to watch it with her and I'd sit down and she'd have to explain the whole backstory. I'm all like, you know, just let me watch it.
I know.
Yeah. Yes. It's like,
yeah. You can enjoy a story out of context, but just as Nicole was obsessed with putting it in context, for you, we are equally obsessed with putting all this in context for the readers of these powerful things called the scriptures and the whole story. It's Paul's teachings, Apollos' teachings. We even like to give you a full context of Peter, James, and John's teachings. We're not trying to hide Peter, James, and John, and we don't poo-poo their letters. We say read their letters, but accept what they say. Don't try to make it into something that they don't say. Don't try to shoehorn their teachings in with Paul and Apollos' teachings, because, boy, you're going to have one sore foot if you're going to try to fit this together between the two.
You know, we've done Peter, James, and John, and I want you to know our listeners are waiting for you to do Revelation, Michael.
Oh, I know.
they keep asking.
I tell you, I like the very first part of Revelation, which says that it's a revelation of Jesus Christ. And then John says he got the revelation in the Spirit on the Lord's day. So that yep. that was the day of the cross, is the day of the Lord. I don't think that loses its meaning anywhere. So, and John says, and I heard a trumpet from behind me blow. Well, John happened to be the only one that was at the cross when Jesus was crucified. Mm. And the trumpet that he would have heard would have been coming from the temple right behind him, based on the location we discovered as to where that Jesus was crucified. And then the very last of it is that wonderful, wonderful verse that Daniel brought to our attention at the very end of Revelation, which was supposed to have been Jesus looking at his mother, talking to her. That's according to Mel Gibson, now we know. Behold, I make all things new. So those two parts I understand. The rest of it, it's up to you.
Well, there you go, folks. 30 seconds. Michael has covered the book of Revelation.
from cover to cover.
So context, context, context. And we are learning the powerful context here out of Micah chapter 4. And perhaps maybe we'll get into chapter 5 today. But Michael, what do you think we walk through that a little bit about what we've gone over the last couple of weeks in Micah chapter 4?
Okay. Let's do that. What did we find out in this, Daniel?
Well, the first three verses, we talked about how this is in reference to the last days. So that gives us a context
yes.
of time, of when these things were to happen. And of course, we have a picture here of judgment. And then its conclusion that in that judgment and in that war, that there would be a time where we wouldn't learn war no more, and the swords would be turned into farming tools. And I think that's a powerful story. And of course, I love that closing verse there in verse 3, neither shall they learn war anymore.
Yes. Now I just have this suspicion in my own heart. People who listen to us know that we are persuaded the gospel was hijacked. It was hijacked primarily by the brother of Jesus, James. We've gone through extensive study with Don Bartlett also into the life of James, how he got involved. You could have good excuse for Peter being the head of the church. You could have a good excuse for John being head of the church. There is no anything about the involvement of James before the cross, except that he made fun of his brother and said he was a lunatic that had lost his mind. Mm. And the only other thing you can say about James is that he hated rich people. All you have to do is read his letter. And I think six times in as many chapters, he just lets you know that rich people don't have a hope in hell. You know, we do read those books and we let them stand. We also know that this powerful comparison between James and Paul's teachings about imputed righteousness. I was looking at that just yesterday, Daniel, and you know, they both quote exactly that Abraham believed God and it was imputed to him for righteousness. Mm-hmm. And Paul also quotes that. But here is the difference between James's persuasion and Paul's persuasion. James was persuaded that after the cross, that's where we still were.
Right.
We were still there with imputed righteousness. Now, this is all brand new stuff that we've learned recently. And it makes this our comprehension of this debate between Paul and James much clearer. And the very same thing that Paul stated about imputed righteousness, but Paul went on in his letter to explain how much more glorious this unimputed righteousness is, that we're now made righteous. James was still persuaded of imputed righteousness. And that's where James came from. And that imputed righteousness, he focused almost entirely on just the Jewish nation and the nation of Israel. In fact, his letter is to the tribes that were scattered abroad from Jerusalem. The interesting thing is that he's writing to the people who were scattered abroad because of Paul's persecution of the church.
Mm.
He didn't like Paul.
No.
And he maintained his connection to those that were persecuted by this man, Paul, and all that he had to do with this. They fled town. And we have the documentation of all of that. And we know who the man was that was kind of leading up the charge. And we know who, can you imagine that strained relationship? Can we call it at least a strained relationship between James and Paul? And then they're beginning to interject in each other's writings, which came first, the chicken or the egg? I don't know. It seems as though that James is responding to Paul's teaching. But he's agreeing with Paul's assessment about imputed righteousness, but says the imputed righteousness also comes with works. And the weird thing is yes, it does come with works. And that's the thing that I missed. I thought that he was being incorrect by saying that imputed righteousness comes completely without works. But his argument is really pretty good about that, because they did this and did that, and Rahab the harlot did this and did that, and that was all a part of, the works were a part of imputed righteousness.
Mm.
But Paul's insistence was that our righteousness is not imputed. We're made righteous. And I'm going to start just shouting here in a minute. Now, this is, folks, this is just so magnificent for anyone to have any concept of. And it is a debate for the ages. I mean, it was going on between James, the hijacker of the church. Now, Don called him James the Jerk, and we will leave that particular moniker for Don so that he can address that in his existence now. And that way people will know who he is. So if you ever hear James the Jerk, you'll know, uh-oh, there's Don. But I really am convinced that James hijacked the gospel. And I think that he made Peter submit to this hijacked gospel. Mm-hmm. Peter is the one who got this magnificent revelation about don't call unclean that which I have cleansed. And then James convinced him not to eat with the Gentiles anymore.
Yeah.
So this is, you know, these are things that, and I guess what we're doing is showing you the style in which we try to research things. And then we rehearse those things, and it doesn't make any sense. What would agree or disagree with this? Just like I've just explained to you, I've adjusted my understanding of this conflict between James and Paul. And I used to say that Paul was right and James was wrong. But they were both right about the righteousness, about imputed righteousness through faith. But Paul was talking about a faith that is without works. Mm-hmm. The only faith that is without works is the faith of God, requires no man's works whatsoever. So this is becoming clear as we go, and as things settle, we stir up a lot of mud, you know, and then sometimes you have to wait until things settle to be able to see clearly again, and then we move forward again. So what's happening here in Micah is a snapshot of a prophecy that has been fulfilled, but our persistence about sharing the gospel to bring this part of this rabbit trail back home is that we do embrace the fact that the implementation and understanding of the gospel will end war. My commitment to the gospel is to bring it back to its own design and not skip over it by teaching an original design, which wipes the gospel out altogether. Please let me help you understand that anyone who teaches the doctrine of original design, that everything was finished in Adam, they have also wiped out the doctrine of the new design, the new creation, that Christ was important on any level whatsoever except as a revealer. And that's just not what the prophets talked about. It's just wrong. It's just, that part is just wrong. So as we're looking at this, why is it important that why are we trying to ferret out the story? Because the story is called the gospel. What is the gospel? It is the power of God. What is the ultimate outcome of the power of God? And they shall learn war no more.
Mm, beautiful.
So why are we sticking to it? Why are we not offended by an angry God in the Hebrew scriptures? Why are we not angered by or upset or offended or put off? Why are we not trying to take that out and explain that that was just Moses, that was man's view of God? Because what you have in that is called conflict resolution between God and man. You take out the conflict, all you have is a spirituality with no power in it. It is a very self-absorbing spirituality. Honestly, gets you to think about you and how wonderful you are and just how wonderful you're going to be and going to stay. But it helps nobody in the arena of conflict resolution. It is so evident that it does not, that mindset does not help conflict resolution. They stay out of conflict altogether because they have no resolution for it. Because there's not a process in them that says that conflict can and will happen, and there is a way to resolve the conflict.
Yeah.
Now, so what do you, when you preach and teach something that the power of it is your identity, but there is nothing in it that teaches you the conflict that had to be resolved for you to have that identity, that identity will cause you to isolate yourself from anybody who disagrees with you because you don't know how to resolve conflict. Because conflict resolution is not in your doctrine. Oh, there's that dirty word again. But you do have a doctrine, but it has no conflict resolution in it. So as we're learning this more and more, what we are understanding is the power of this conflict resolution that has been presented in where God poured out his wrath and judgment and anger at the cross. And Jesus said, now is the judgment of the whole world. And if I be lifted up, I'm going to draw all that judgment unto me. And that judgment was satisfied and filled. And I know that, they would be running for the hills right now just hearing this. Even though it says all of this, every place you look, it says this. This is very offensive to our friends. But believe me, if you're going to live this life, I hope that what you have been persuaded of spiritually has conflict resolution in it. And there is no greater conflict resolution than the cross. Mm. And as a result of that, there's no greater conflict resolution thinking than the gospel. And the gospel is the power of God. To what point? They shall learn war no more.
Now think about that. If we were willing to throw out the Hebrew scriptures, this is a Hebrew scripture, yes, that we would have to throw out. This is the power of the gospel. This is the power of what Michael was saying about learning about the conflict resolution, about accepting the fact that God was angry and he's no longer angry. And this is all laid out in this beautiful story. And this is just one, Michael, this is a half a verse, a quarter of a verse in the whole, all of the Hebrew scriptures. And we're just not willing to throw it away because we believe that this one line is just a powerful enough to hold on to the Hebrew scriptures, because it's what we all want. Yeah. It's what we're all looking for.
Yeah, I think that we would all have to agree that they shall learn war no more would be something that everyone would want, unless your brain has been turned to mush by power. Power will turn your brain to mush. You have no ability at conflict resolution whatsoever. If power is what you want, power, your desire for power will lead to war. It will lead to conflict. It will not lead to conflict resolution. So from there, Daniel, then we went on down and we found out how that as a result of this incredible conflict resolution, everybody would have his own fig tree. So he can sit on his own fig tree. But at the same time, it says, and they're not going to be afraid. There's a reason it says that they're not going to be afraid. Not going to be afraid of what? The wolf down at the foot of the hill? This doesn't have anything to do with wolves or bears and lions and tigers. This has,
oh my,
oh my, oh my. The oh my that has been done away with is the resolve of the anger of God. It's amazing how the gospel presents this absolute individuality, but the absolute commonality of being one.
Wow, I absolutely love that.
And so the people say, well, the gospel only teaches being one. No, the gospel teaches immense individuality, personal responsibility. It is amazing how much that it shows that your life is lived out by your decisions and by taking responsibility for those decisions. Yet at the same time, we are all one. It teaches both simultaneously. So we go down through those verses, and then we begin again in verse 6. In that day, saith the Lord, I will assemble her that halteth, and I will gather her that is driven out, and her that I have afflicted. Now, remember, we stopped there, but Daniel, we went back just for a moment and we looked at this word afflicted. Now, remember what we were showing you was that Mary was an outcast from the temple because of three categories of disqualification: moral outcast, a social outcast, or a physical outcast. And we could show you in any number of places where that the lame were disqualified, number one, for holding any position, but it also indicates that they were also not permitted in the temple. Say that the least, these people would have been frowned upon if they had even been seen in or around the temple. In fact, what you have is these people outside the temple begging for money. So if you were in this position of moral or social or physical outcast, you had no means of livelihood. Just think of this just a moment. What happens to somebody who is a moral outcast, who is a social outcast, and a outcast on a physical level? Now, thank goodness, you know, we're moving past some of these issues that people with disabilities are not excluded from having certain jobs. You know, you can be a congressman, you can be a senator, and you can be the president of the United States and have a physical disability. And so we've moved past that. But the time was, you know, even when Roosevelt was president, they hid his paralysis because of the way people still deal with was dealing at that time and still do with a less than qualified human being, if you were, as put the scriptures here, puts it, lame. Now, Mary mm-hmm. was not incapable of movement. In fact, if you look the word here about being lame, it means to be, to walk haltedly and to be not totally crippled, but it's like, you know, somebody that would have had a bad hip or a leg shorter than the other or a bad knee. We don't know.
But we'll just grow it out.
Yeah, exactly. Isn't that what we always did? And you have to grow out a leg, you have to have a good puller praying. You have to know how to pull, and you also have to have a person that's willing to be pulled sitting in the chair. And then it works every time, doesn't it, Daniel?
Yeah.
All right. So we continue through this.
Just to jump in there real quick, on that word afflicted, we learned in the Hebrew, it does mean exactly what Michael said it meant. It means to be afflicted physically, socially, or morally.
It covered all three of them, didn't it?
It sure did.
We just did that earlier, and I was just blown away, you know, that. Yep. And now, who was she? How did she become afflicted? This was God who did this.
Page on.
Yeah. Uh-oh. So we can't even finish studying this. Just page on. But to say that Mary was not afflicted, let's take it back to just social and moral. She was afflicted.
Sure.
Because of the culture she lived in. That was an incredible affliction that was put upon her, was to become pregnant outside of marriage. Now, people say, well, it was Joseph's child. You know, you can debate that all you want, but this point you cannot win. And that is that she was not married to Joseph before she became pregnant with the Christ child. That story is well covered, and this other issue, though, we only found out this about her being lame here in the book of Micah, and we've also talked about some stories in the New Testament that would indicate that was a great possibility also, that she may have been physically lame. And according to Micah, it would be a definite that she was. Goodness gracious, we read on down, verse 8. We're going to try not to read everything all over to you again. And thou, O tower of the flock. That term is a very specific term. It's a tower. The term tower is used many times in the Hebrew scriptures. But this is the tower of the flock. This was some very specific, you can look it up. The Hebrew words is Migdal Eder. Is that correct?
Yeah, Migdal Eder.
Migdal Eder. And you can Google that if you want. And there's a tremendous amount of history about Migdal Eder. And it is the tower outside of Bethlehem. And as we begin to point out those comparisons to you, that how that the shepherds would have known exactly where Jesus was being kept after his birth by saying that, you know, you'll find the babe wrapped in swaddling clothes lying in a manger. This was their business. They knew that they were in the business. These shepherds were in the business of overseeing a flock that was giving birth to sacrificial lambs.
My goodness.
And this is a place called Migdal Eder. And Migdal Eder is very much a part of Hebrew history. And we pointed out a lot of the comparisons. One of them I missed, Daniel, is that Jesus's life began outside of the gates of Bethlehem, and his life ended outside the gates of Jerusalem.
Mm.
His life started out of a carving out of the stone, and his life ended in a grave that was hewn out of stone. The comparisons just run rampant, and it's such a beautiful, beautiful story. So I'm not concerned at all that we're repeating this to you, because, folks, this is something you've never known before. Mm-hmm. None of us did. We made mention of it, and what we're doing now is going back to pick these things up so that we can log them now in our memory. We've gone through these things so blazing fast that, man, it's like, oh, yeah, oh, I do remember that. We want it to be a part of the way we think instead of something that is occasionally a reminder. This is such a beautiful, huge picture of the conception, the birth of Christ, all of these things. And this is where this is affirmed so strongly here. And then he says, "And now, O tower of the flock, the stronghold of the daughter of Zion." This was the safe place, the stronghold. This is the place where the daughter of Zion. Now, this is where I finally realized that the term daughter of Zion is, that's Mary's Hebrew scripture moniker.
Mm.
And which leads us to how many places does the word daughter of Zion show up in the Hebrew scriptures, Daniel? Wasn't it about 28, 26, 28?
Something like that. Yeah, something like that. 20, 26, I think.
Yeah. So at this point, what I want to do is show you. Now, this term, O daughter of Zion, shows up three times just here in the book of Micah. So it shows up in verse 13. It shows up in verse 8 and
4:8, 4:10, 4:13, and also 1:13.
Yes. So all of those places, just the term daughter of Zion shows up. Now, out of the Hebrew scriptures, how many times does the daughter of Zion? Now, let me say this also. As you see here, the daughter of Jerusalem shows up in the same verse along with some of these statements, right?
Yep.
So the daughter of Zion and the daughter of Jerusalem show up simultaneously, giving us the indication that daughter of Zion, daughter of Jerusalem, may indeed be the moniker of the Hebrew scriptures for Mary, the mother of Jesus. Now, how many times does the word daughter of Zion show up?
It's like 29.
So only 29 times does this show up in the entire Hebrew scriptures. Let's pull out two or three of them, Daniel, and just see if there's a possibility that we're on to something. Have we caught a big fish? Or, you know, is this some something insignificant, or is it very significant? What do we have here?
Here is one in Isaiah 37 and verse 22. This is the word which the Lord has spoken concerning him. The virgin, the daughter of Zion, hath despised thee and laughed thee to scorn. The daughter of Jerusalem has shaken her head at thee.
Yeah, kind of Mary's response when he said, you know, you're going to have a baby and it's not going to be Joseph's. So what happens? What happens when you tell a virgin she's going to have a baby and without having sex with a man?
You so crazy.
Yeah, I'd like to have an excuse for my mama, but you're just nuts, dude. So it even calls the daughter of Zion there what? A virgin, right?
A virgin, yeah. Yep.
All right. So is there anything else that would support that we may have discovered the Hebrew moniker for the Virgin Mary? Now we know it's the virgin, right?
Yep. Isaiah chapter 52 and verse 2. Shake thyself from the dust. Arise and sit down, O Jerusalem. Loose thyself from the bands of thy neck, O captive daughter of Zion.
Yes, and if there was anybody captive, it was Mary. Man, she was bound. She was predestined. She was predestined to give birth to a child, the very first woman to give birth to a child that did not belong to the seed of a man. Goodness.
Oh, wow. Listen to this one. Isaiah 62:11. Behold, the Lord has proclaimed unto the end of the world. Say ye to the daughter of Zion, behold, thy salvation cometh. Mm. Behold, his reward is with him and his work before him. Wow.
At this point, prove us wrong. That's what you do with a thesis. This is our thesis we're presenting to you. Maybe for the first time on planet Earth, that the daughter of Zion, daughter of Jerusalem, is indeed the Virgin Mary. Is there anything else that would support this in the Hebrew scriptures?
Oh, it gets clearer. Jeremiah 4:31. For I heard the voice as of a woman in travail, and the anguish as of her that bringeth forth her first child. The voice of the daughter of Zion, that bewaileth herself, that spreadeth her hand, saying, woe is me now, for my soul is wearied because of the murderers.
Wow. Well, I don't know if you know the story or not, but right after Jesus was born, there were murderers after her.
Mm.
Is it just a fluke that this daughter of Zion was giving birth to her firstborn? Come on. Anything else, as if we needed anything else?
Yeah, I got a couple more here. Jeremiah 6:23. They shall lay hold on bow and spear. They are cruel. They have no mercy. Their voice roareth like the sea, and they ride upon horses, set in array as man for war against thee, O daughter of Zion.
Tell me that's not Herod's army.
Mm.
Can you imagine this vicious army? How vicious did this army have to be? To be riding around the entirety of Judea, looking for to murder every firstborn. The fear, it's just, you know, you've got to, as we read these things, we've got to realize this was a terrifying time for every woman in Judea. These horses, these bands of armies were combing the countrysides. They weren't just going into the cities. They were riding up to every place they heard there was a child there. And once they got there, they murdered the child.
My God.
Is there anything else that of these 29 verses? Gosh, you've already covered 5 or 6 of them.
Well, it's interesting, Michael, in Lamentations, there are like 6, 7, 8 references here.
In Lamentations. How about that?
Especially chapter 2. So I think we need to put out an ABP to our gospel revolutionaries. Get into Lamentations and let us know what's in there.
Well, I mean, wouldn't it make sense, though, that the Lamentation would be over this entire birth conflict and the murder of all of these Hebrew children and the attempted murder? This is the story about the attempted murder of the Christ.
Mm.
Tell me that's not a lamentation upon the land.
Yeah.
That the very source of salvation to Israel and the world, tell me that this lamentation was not about Mary.
And if I remember correctly, we just read those verses out of Jeremiah. I believe it was Jeremiah who wrote Lamentations. So
wow.
Imagine him prophesying all of that and then the lamentation that would come from that.
Wow. Once he saw that. Oh, my gosh. Wow. That's very powerful. No wonder there were lamentations.
Yeah.
What does Lamentations say about these?
Here is one in Lamentations 2:10. The elders of the daughter of Zion sit upon the ground and keep silence. They have cast up dust upon their heads. They have girded themselves with sackcloth. The virgins of Jerusalem hang down their heads to the ground.
Mary had brought shame upon every woman in Jerusalem. The elders, they knew genealogy. They knew that she was a daughter of the king of King David. They knew who she was.
Yep.
These people kept up with their genealogy, believe me. And if you don't believe that, go back and read everything that's recorded about genealogy and tell me they didn't know that. And the shame, the horrible shame, this is a descendant of King David, and she is not married, and she's pregnant.
Mm.
And the elders are casting dirt in the air. And every virgin in all of Judea is they're ashamed. They are ashamed of what has happened. And man, I tell you what, conflict resolution, folks. Don't miss the power of the conflict, because you'll miss the power of the resolution.
Here's one with the resolution. Zechariah 9:9. Rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. Shout, O daughter of Jerusalem. Behold, thy king cometh unto thee. He is just and having salvation, lowly and riding upon an ass. Wow. And upon the colt, the foal of an ass.
Wow. Yes. Oh my gosh. So this incredible story, and Daniel's taken at least a third of those 29 verses. And like I say, proves wrong that this is not all about Mary. We may have identified today that all of Lamentations is about this period of time. Mm. All of Lamentations is about this from the prophet Jeremiah, as Daniel has just pointed out to us. And we're going to have to change your name. I need to have a Daniel and then a Daniel 2. You're both pretty smart guys, right?
Yeah, one just prophesied the end of sin, you know.
That's right. And one gets to experience it, right? So
yeah, exactly.
You're all one. So here we are with Jeremiah the prophet who spoke of the daughter of Jerusalem, who prophesied about this incredible event. And then can you imagine, it's almost like his second show, if you will, on his prophecies about the daughter of Zion. And can you imagine this becoming a reality to him?
Mm.
And then beginning to see, my God, the implications of this, just to get to the other side of the lamentations of the story, the lamenting and the sorrow, the shame of the elders, the shame of every virgin in Judea, the shame of those at the temple, the shame of the lineage of the king of King David. And here she is pregnant. And they know that the couple has not been married yet.
Wow.
I tell you, if you wanted to anoint somebody as king, and the plot was to make him look like the savior of Israel, I don't think this would be the way to do it.
No.
You wouldn't disqualify him on every realm if you're going to prove that it's him. Mm. Folks, I want you to see how ignorant these accusations are about the Hebrew scriptures and about people who try to say that, oh, they went back and they figured it all out. No, nobody figured it out. It wasn't even known until after the resurrection that these scriptures were able to even be seen in clear light. But why in the world would you, if you want somebody to be anointed the king of all, the king of Israel, the king of all the whole world, why in the world would you hide him behind everything contrary to everything that his culture would say would be an indication this could be a king?
Mm-hmm.
It was all completely cloaked. It was their eyes were stopped. Do you see how that these Hebrew scriptures even kept their eyes from seeing or their ears from hearing, and that they couldn't see and they couldn't hear? Why? Because they weren't supposed to see. They weren't supposed to hear. This was supposed to be a covert operation. This was supposed to be a God and God, the two who spoke all things into existence. Now one of them manifested in a body on earth, and God, and coming together to carry off a covert operation to bring God and the human race together as one entity. I love the Hebrew scriptures, Daniel.
Yeah.
I'm loving them more all of the time.
Mm-hmm.
Not less. I am more intrigued. I'm more fascinated. I'm energized by the scriptures to find out the power of this story. So Daniel, as pertaining to what we were just talking about, Now look what it says. Let's do 10, 11, and 12. We're seeing more in this, but let's just look at this again before we close out this show. And then I promise you, we'll get to chapter 5. be in pain and labor to bring forth, O daughter of Zion, like a woman in travail, for now shalt thou go forth out of the city, and thou shalt dwell in the field, and thou shalt go even to Babylon. That's what happened.
Yeah.
That's exactly what happened. Is that once Mary gave birth, they were on the run.
Mm-hmm.
Because once the kings alerted Herod that there was a child born that's going to be the king of Israel, remember the story. They went into, in fact, can we find a place in the New Testament that tells us what happened to Mary and Joseph immediately after the birth of Christ? They just go back home and start taking care of the animals and the flocks and the crops?
Yes, Michael. In Matthew chapter 2 and verse 13. Now, when they had departed, so the wise men came and they offered gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And then they were warned in a dream that they should not return to Herod. And they departed in their own country another way. And then in verse 13 of Matthew chapter 2, it says, now when they had departed, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream, saying, arise, take the young child and his mother, and flee to Egypt.
Wow.
And stay there until I bring you word, for Herod will seek the young child to destroy him.
Now, do we have any record that Egypt was ever a part of Babylon?
Yes, in Ezekiel chapter 30 and verse 10 and 11. It reads, I will put an end to the wealth of Egypt by the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon.
Wow. Yeah. So the king of Babylon. This records where Egypt became a part of Babylon because they were defeated in battle, and that made it a part of Babylon. But you see how intricately hidden all of these prophecies were. Why didn't they say Egypt? Because it was hidden behind the word Babylon.
Mm.
So why would it be Babylon? Because you got to study your Hebrew scriptures to see that Babylon was indeed in a possession of Egypt. They were defeated in battle, and that. But see, every one of these little intricacies, Daniel, they are hidden to be revealed.
Yeah,
hidden to be revealed. Hidden to be revealed over and over and over again.
Michael, I read on a little bit here in Matthew chapter 2, and there's a reference to a prophecy by Hosea. And I think you like this. This is Hosea chapter 11 and verse 1. When Israel was a child, I loved him, and out of Egypt I called my son.
My goodness. Jesus was called out of Egypt. And guess who else was called out of Egypt? It was Moses.
Page on, brother. Just page on.
You got to get rid of this obsession with Moses. I'm telling you, I feel like Moses is defender now. It's like I want to defend this man who should need no defense. But sometimes, folks, history repeats itself. Moses suffered the affliction of the people of Israel. He chose to suffer affliction to follow his understanding of the Christ. You just may have to suffer affliction again, Moses, in the modern day. It shouldn't have to be. But here we do already have a very large number of people who are afflicting even the memory of Moses after he already had to go through all of this and suffering affliction because of his association with Christ, is what Hebrews 11 says. So the rest of this verse then says, there the Lord shall redeem thee from the hand of thine enemies. So how did going into Babylon, did God redeem the daughter of Zion and whatever she was given travail in birth for, how did that how did he save her from the enemies? Because King Herod only had jurisdiction over Judea.
Mm-hmm.
And so they went into Egypt, into Babylon, and that's where God delivered them from their enemies.
And Matthew tells us that they stayed there until Herod's death.
Yes.
And that's when they came back home.
They stayed there until Herod's death. That is, oh, man. All right. Page on, I suppose. I don't know. And then it goes on to say, now also many nations are gathered together against thee and say, let her be defiled and let her eye look upon Jerusalem. But they know not the thoughts of the Lord, and neither understand they his counsel, for he shall gather them as sheaves into the floor.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't know the plan. You can speak all the disgrace upon Moses and this whole process you want, but the process that Moses went through and the process that Jesus went through is what got you to the point to where you are, is the reason that you're not being stricken dead because of insulting Christ and Moses.
Mm.
Because you're righteous and holy, without blame and without fault, even in God, in Christ, the ones in whom you insult and say that their work was not according to your plan, therefore the plan could not have been God's plan. And then verse 13, arise and thresh, O daughter of Zion, and I will make thine horn iron, and I will make thy hoofs brass, and thou shalt beat into pieces many nations. Well, all nations were beaten to pieces. And the end result of it was they were supposed to be then beating into pieces their implements of war. And I consecrate their gain unto the Lord and their substance unto the Lord of the whole earth. And then, goodness, it starts with chapter 5.
So send in your money, folks, if you want to get to chapter 5. We want your money.
Oh, goodness. We really appreciate you guys hanging in there with us. Daniel and I have just had a very fun hour, and we hope that it was a very fun one for you also. If you want to get ahead of us, keep reading Micah. Maybe you'll find things here that will help us out more than we ever knew.
And so it is. We must leave you, family and friends. If you'd like to know anything about the Gospel Revolution, then call our office on
832-318-9339.
And speak to us about how you want to participate, or go to www.gospelrevolution.com and hit the connect link. You can find us on your favorite social media network, Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. We sure do like it when you hit that subscribe, share, like, and leave a comment on each platform that you listen. And now it's good night from Daniel Rouse in the frozen tundra.
And it's good night from Michael Williams right here in the secret city. We really appreciate everything that you guys do. You make doing fun. You make the work of the ministry, if you will, fun. We don't have to go around worrying about how things are going to be taken care of, because you guys truly do take care of everything for us, and we appreciate it so much.
We sure hope that you enjoyed today's PowerCast. And remember, just because you're offended, and remember, we'll be here to do the same thing all over again next week, only
I rebuke you, Don Bartlett. Only Micah chapter 5.
Knocking on the door, you're begging to come in, yeah. Unaware that all the wildness been knocking from within. You are the love you seek, a perfect gift you need, righteous and holy. Yeah, 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 yeah. When you're lost and alone, stand.
knowing you gotta be nothing to complete. It's not a thing that you need, you're the love. Just remember to breathe and take a second off. Look, I'm just trying to remind you that you're perfectly divine. Flawlessly designed. When you're lost and alone, staring at the unknown, that this world's been a come.
Constructing religion and barbecuing the sacred cows of Christianity before your very eyes. You are listening to
Gospel Revolution.